Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive.
Quite frankly, I get most of my news from you.
Joan Esposito.
Y'all ready for this?
On WCPT 820.
Hello, thanks for joining me this Tuesday, April 13th. I am so glad you are here today. I wish we could kick back, put our feet up, talk about our favorite poems, but that is not the case today. We have lots of news coming out of the Chauvin trial, lots of news coming out of the other situation where a young man was killed in Brooklyn Center. And first and foremost, there is news on the vaccine front. I'm sure you have heard by now, but let me give you all the information. Here in the United States, the FDA has decided to put a hold. They're not banning. They're not stopping. They're putting a hold on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine while they take a deeper dive into the data. First and foremost, if you are panicking now because you have an appointment to get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine somewhere, medical center, your local pharmacy, don't worry. The word is all of those appointments are going to be honored, but when you show up, you're going to get either the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine. Governor Pritzker said today that he's moving 50,000 doses around to cover these appointments. So what's going on with Johnson & Johnson? Probably nothing, okay? But this all is very new. As I said before, the science behind COVID is like trying to learn how to drive a car while you're in the car going 100 miles an hour. So whenever there's anything that maybe gives anybody the impression that things might not be exactly right, they're going to err on the side of caution. And that's exactly what we want from our scientists, okay? If you are scheduled to get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, don't worry. You can still go to your appointment. You can confirm it if you want, but you will still go to your appointment and you will be given Moderna or Pfizer until the scientists at the FDA have a chance to do a deeper dive into the data. What are they worried about? 6.85 million. Now, nearly 7 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine have been given in this country. Six women aged 18 to 48 developed a blood clot. Now, again, I'm sure in that 6.85 million people, there were also hundreds of people who had heart attacks and hundreds of people who were diagnosed with brain cancer and hundreds of people who were diagnosed with kidney disease. Does that mean it's cause and effect? No, because anytime you have a population that large, people are going to get sick. Stuff's going to happen. But particularly because there was some concern about this same kind of data with AstraZeneca, they've decided to put a hold and they're going to take a deeper look at the data. Six women aged 18 to 48 developed a blood clot in their brain. It happened within 6 to 13 days after they got the shot. So if you're somebody who got the Johnson & Johnson shot a month ago, you got nothing to worry about. There was another factor that all these six women shared. They all had a low platelet count. Platelets are the things that float around in your bloodstream. And when you cut yourself, the platelets are what come together and form a clot. Hemophiliacs don't clot. They need to get platelets. Platelets are these little sticky things that are in your blood. And when you cut yourself, the sticky things stick together and they make a blood clot. All six of these women had low platelets. Is that some sort of trigger factor? Is this just what would be expected? in a population this size? That's what the scientists want to take a closer look at. So what are they going to do? They're going to look at the data they've got. They're going to reach out to all the major medical centers. They're going to make sure that the data they've got is completely up to date. And then they're going to look at it, and they're going to look at the statistics. In a population of 7 million people, would you expect 6 women to develop these blood clots? Because there is a certain number of people in that percentage of millions that will develop blood clots. So you have to take a look at, is this something that we can expect? Or is this something that is a danger? Dr. Anthony Fauci said today that he believes that is only within the first month that you have to worry about this. Does that mean hard and fast that people who've taken the J&J are completely in the clear? No, but that's what the data looks like now. Tomorrow, I could have more information for you. Okay, let's say you're a woman between the ages of 18 and 48, and a week and a half ago, you got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. How do you know if your symptoms, assuming you have any, are serious? Here's what we know so far. As one physician said on television today, we are not talking about the usual post-vaccine fever and chills, you know, a little bit of achiness. He said, we are talking about symptoms that you would describe as extraordinary changes. Severe headache. And I'm not talking about, oh gosh, because with Moderna, I had a really bad headache. But it wasn't. People with blood clots describe the pain as take your breath away, can't think, can't move, feel like you're going to pass out kind of pain. Can't think of anything else except the pain in your head. Extraordinary pain. If you find that you've lost your ability to think, that's a warning sign. Severe swelling of legs, severe shortness of breath that lasts, isn't just for a few minutes. And of course, if you are with somebody and they're having a seizure, that would be something to sit up and pay attention to. These would be extraordinary symptoms. But I'm telling you that for the vast majority of people, there's nothing to worry about. As one expert in statistics put it earlier today, still looking at these numbers, you have a greater chance of being in a car accident that kills you. You have a greater chance of dying in a car accident than you have of developing a blood clot in your brain from Johnson & Johnson, okay? So this is not reason to panic. They are doing this as out of an abundance of caution. Nobody's even sure there's a connection. That's what they want to take a look at. They want to sift through the data yet again and make sure that there's nothing that jumps out at them. So I don't want you to panic if you got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I want you to be aware. I want you to have the knowledge that is available to us right now. And again, this is science, and it's really frustrating that science doesn't always have hard and fast yes and no, black and white kind of answers. That isn't the way science works when you've got something that is a situation that is changing from day to day. When doctors first started treating COVID patients in the hospital, they used therapies and techniques that they believed would be effective, and now they do things completely differently. There are treatments that were considered very experimental, and, you know, maybe it'll help, maybe it won't. Well, now we know that they do. Dr. Anthony Fauci gave a special news conference today. And I want to share a little bit about what he had to say about this. He has a tendency to speak in medical terminology, but here he's explaining why the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is being paused for now. Listen to this.
A couple of issues come up of the importance of calling this pause, because people say, what does a pause mean? It really allows both the FDA and the CDC to further investigate these cases to try and understand some of the mechanisms of what it is, some more details about the history of the individuals who are involved that might shed some light on looking forward, what will happen and what we will do. That's the first thing. The other thing is to make physicians out there aware of this. And there are some clinical implications of that that I believe are important. For example, if someone comes in with this really rather rare syndrome of thrombotic thrombocytopenia, where you get thromboses, and when you have thromboses, the most common way to treat that is with heparin. That would be a mistake in this situation because it could be dangerous and make the situation much worse. So there's a clinically relevant reason why you want to make this known to people. Also, when individuals, particularly younger women, who might come into a physician with a particular thrombotic phenomenon, which is things that happen for other reasons all the time, that we want to alert physicians to take a history of a recent vaccination. That would be important.
Okay. Yeah. That when he talks about thrombotic thrombocytopenia, basically he's talking about blood clot in your brain. OK, that's the medical terminology for blood clot. And what he wants doctors to know is if somebody comes in and the doctor suspects there is a blood clot in the brain, they need to know whether or not they got this Johnson & Johnson vaccination, because if it is a certain, that means it might be a certain type of blood clot that will not respond best to what would be, under other circumstances, the standard treatment for a brain blood clot. Okay, does that make sense to you? That in those rare occasions where people have developed these clots and gone to the hospital, doctors need to be aware that the sort of usual treatment that they would do for somebody in this situation might not be the best treatment for somebody who's had a vaccination, and that they should think of a secondary line of treatment for those people. Okay, you got me. You with me so far? One of the other reasons why Dr. Fauci went on television today, he said, you know, he really wants to be transparent about this. When we come back, we're going to hear more from Dr. Fauci about how he doesn't want people to lose confidence in the vaccines now more than ever, when we're at this critical point of almost getting enough people vaccinated to really not worry so much anymore. We'll have more on what Dr. Fauci said. We're going to bring you up to date on the developments in the shooting of Dante Wright in Brooklyn Center, Minneapolis, and of course on the Derek Chauvin trial, all that and more right after this.
Don't want to call but have something to say?
Am I on the air?
You can now text us at 773-763-9278. WCPT's text line is sponsored by GWC Injury Lawyers. Visit them at justicestartstoday.com.
This is WCPT 820, where facts matter.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
We've been talking about the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine. It was announced today that it is on hold. It is on hold until the experts can take a deeper dive into the data. Six women between the ages of 18 and 48 developed a blood clot. 6.85 million doses of the vaccine have been given to Americans. So it's less than one in a million is what we've got here. But out of an abundance of caution, they're going to pause it. They want to talk to public departments of health. They want to talk to hospitals. They want to make sure they've got the latest data. They want to make sure there's not a trend there. Okay. It is not a ban. We don't We're not saying that it's dangerous. Don't panic if you've gotten it. The women who developed symptoms did so between 6 and 13 days post-shot. And again, less than one in a million have developed this. And I don't know what the statistics are for that particular sort of medical problem. You know, you can look up the statistics. Out of 7 million people, how many in the general population would you expect to have a heart attack? And you can get those numbers. Right now, one statistician was saying that you have more of a chance of dying in a car crash than getting this particular problem because of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But they are going to stop for now. They're going to look into it. If you have an appointment to get vaccinated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you can double check with the clinic, but Governor Pritzker and all of the health officials at the federal level have said anybody who's got a J&J appointment, you can still go to it, and you will get either Pfizer or Moderna. Two shots instead of one. And one of the subjects, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's head infectious disease expert, one of the things that he talked about today was taking this action out of an abundance of caution, because the last thing he wants is people to be afraid of getting their vaccinations. He wants people to be confident. He wants to make sure that they don't change their attitude toward the process of getting vaccinated. This is what Dr. Fauci had to say about that.
What impact is this going to have about people's attitudes about vaccines in general? So you might know that there have been now 120 million people that have received at least one dose of a vaccine. Most of that, subtract the 6.85 million, is in the messenger RNA from Pfizer and from Moderna. There have been no red flag signals from those. So you're talking about tens and tens and tens of millions of people who've received vaccine with no adverse effect. This is a really rare event. If you look at what we know so far, there have been six out of the 6.85 million doses, which is less than one in a million. So remember, this is something that we always, out of an abundance of caution, as Jeff said, to give us a time to take a good look at it and see if we can get further information.
So that's where we stand right now on the Johnson & Johnson. It's been paused. They're going to take another look at the data. So those of you who really hate to get shots and you were looking forward to having one and done, sorry, you're now going to be in the same boat as most of the rest of us, and you're going to have to get two shots. So, you know, for now, that's okay, as long as you get vaccinated. Also want to bring you quickly up to date on what's happened in the situation with Dante Wright. He was the 20-year-old black man pulled over for a traffic stop, and after a struggle with police, he was shot by an officer who apparently thought she had grabbed her taser, and instead she grabbed her gun. She shot Dante Wright. He died very shortly thereafter. We heard the audio from that. I mean, she was like, oh, my God, I shot him. And the other officer goes, wow. And she goes, I shot him. That officer's been identified as Kim Potter. She has resigned. And the Brooklyn Center Police Chief, Tim Gannon, also announced today that he was resigning. Yesterday, it was really interesting because, you know, right after this, in the full interest of transparency, the mayor of Brooklyn Center, the police chief of Brooklyn Center, Tim Gannon, they were doing a press conference. They released the body cam footage. They didn't release the officer's name, but they were making an effort toward transparency. And in the Q&A after their statements, Tim Gannon was specifically asked if he was going to resign over this. And he said, no. He said, I have no intention of resigning. That didn't last even 24 hours. The mayor of Brooklyn Center and its new police chief had a news conference. There were some community leaders there, some members of the media. It happened just a couple of hours ago. And one of the members of the community asked the new police chief, you know, what's your plan? What's your plan for how we move forward? And he looked at the person and he said, honestly, I don't have a plan. I just got this job 1 hour ago. So give me a little bit of time and there's going to be a plan. But as of this moment in time, I don't have a plan. Kim Potter, by the way, was a longtime officer with Brooklyn Center Police. 26 years she was with them. And in a letter, she wrote, I've loved every minute of being a police officer, but I believe it's in the best interest of the community, the department, and my fellow officers if I resign immediately. It was pointed out by a former police chief being interviewed on cable news today that one of the things that happens because she is resigning and not being fired is she would probably be eligible for her full pension. Anyway, and a community activist brought up she might even be able to get work with another police force. That's where that stands. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we are going to talk with former Watergate prosecutor Jill Wine Banks. We're going to talk about the latest developments in the Derek Chauvin trial and the death of George Floyd, also in Minneapolis. That and more after this.
Take Jonah Esposito, live, local, and progressive with you on the go by using the TuneIn app on your phone. Just search for WCPT 820. This is Jonah Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
We have a lot of news today. We've got news about vaccines. We've got developments in the shooting death of Dante Wright in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. There, the officer involved and the police chief have resigned. And the Derek Chauvin trial progresses. The prosecution has rested their case, and the defense has begun today. Their first witness, one of their first witnesses was, as we expected, an expert on use of force. Of course, as opposed to the experts we've heard from so far, assuming that this guy is hired by the defense, what we're going to hear this guy say is, well, of course, what Derek Chauvin did was perfectly appropriate. Otherwise, the defense wouldn't be calling this expert. But here's the weird thing. There are lots of experts in lots of fields who frequently get called on to testify in court cases. Many of them get paid to do so. But if somebody's got a really good reputation, they're really good at what they do, whether they're whether they do forensic autopsies or whether they're, you know, cardiologists or experts on this disease or experts on this police procedure. I mean, prosecutors and defense lawyers know who those people are. And when they've got a case where they feel somebody would be of help to them, they know who to reach out to. This witness who's been on the stand this morning testifying for the defense, after the murder of George Floyd, when Derek Chauvin was charged with second degree, third degree murder and manslaughter, this guy called up the prosecution and was like, hey, I'm an expert witness on this. You should hire me. He's $375 for testimony, $275 to look over your case. You should hire me, like an ambulance chaser. Hey, I do this. You should call me. You should call me. I could be good for you. Which gives me a kind of a creepy feeling about this guy. There are lots of experts who testify on a lot of issues. And lawyers know who's really good on what they do. So why did this guy feel he didn't have enough of a reputation? He said he's been doing this for a long time. It just, to me, puts a weird light on what he says. I knew that the defense was going to call experts on use of force and that they were going to defend what the defense was doing. But it just strikes me as a little off that this guy called them up. And he went to the prosecution first. He was like, hire me, hire me. And the prosecution took a pass. So then he went to the defense and he was like, hire me, hire me. I don't know. I just think that's weird. I'm joined now by a former federal prosecutor, former Watergate prosecutor, author of The Watergate Girl, Jill Winebanks. Hey, Jill, how are you?
Good morning, or good afternoon, Joan. It's great to talk to you. And I loved your comments.
Well, you know, I know that there are always expert witnesses, and sometimes experts specialize in working for the defense or working for the prosecution, which is one kind of thing that I think would be a red flag to a jury, that they always have a certain side. But do you think, I mean, the defense made no bones about the fact, you know, how did, you know, how many times have you done this? What do you get paid? How did we come to find you? Well, I reached out to the prosecution. Do you think that's weird that this guy called them up and was like, hey, you should call me, hire me?
Well, first of all, getting paid is not, I don't think that should affect how the jury perceives him. Some of the prosecution witnesses were paid and some weren't.
I don't think there's anything wrong with getting paid. I think it's weird that it strikes me as sort of ambulance chasing, you know, the cliche of a lawyer who sees a car accident and gets everybody's name and number so he can try to represent them. I don't know. It seems to me if he were really good at his job, people would come to him.
On that point, I think you're right, that none of the prosecution witnesses reached out to the state. The state reached out to them. And in this case, he did reach out to the state. The state said, no, thank you. And it's I'm listening to his testimony now, it's not clear whether he then reached out to the defense or the defense found him. I will point out that he did say that he had testified on behalf of the Minnesota Police Department in the past, that he has been a state witness in Minnesota. So he has been used. Now, it may be that experience that made them say, no, thank you, that he turned out not to be the kind of expert they wanted. I'd like to see the full testimony and the cross-examination, more importantly. I've seen, I believe, most of his direct examination, and it's in complete disregard of the facts that everybody else testified to and the opinions that every other expert has testified to, including the police chief and everybody else from Minnesota. So it stands in stark contrast, and you add to that the suspicion you have, hey, I tried to testify for the state and they wouldn't let me, so here I am, which will, in the mind of the jury, affect his credibility. And the cross-examination by the state has forced him to back off some of his more extreme statements. So he said at first that had he quibbled about, or argued, it's more than quibbling, about whether the defendant was on top of Mr. Floyd. And so the prosecutor very calmly went through the facts and forced him to say, well, okay, both knees were on top of him. So he had to back off of that. And he said it wouldn't cause pain, so it therefore wasn't a use of force even, as opposed to even an improper use of force. It wasn't even a use of force. And on cross, he had to say, well, yeah, it could cause pain. And so he reluctantly admits that, therefore, it's a use of force. So far, I'd say the prosecution is doing better than the defense with a defense witness.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, I've been on the air, but, you know, when he first took the stand And it wasn't even, well, you know, nothing was qualified. He just looked at the defense attorney and he goes, oh, it was absolutely a correct use of force. It was absolutely appropriate. And I thought to myself, guy, have you not been watching this trial to this point?
Right. I mean, or haven't you been watching the video?
Yes, yes. And I almost think he would have been more believable to the jury if he'd have said, well, you know, people can see certain situations differently. And when you're, you know, when you're stressed, you might see it differently. But no, it was like flat out, oh, no, there was nothing. There was nothing wrong with this. It was absolutely by the book. And I'm like, oh, you're not helping this guy at all. So, Jill, we had talked before about the defense strategy. How do you see the defense strategy at this point in time in week three?
Well, the defense has a limited amount of possible options in terms of tactics and strategy. They can challenge, but let me start by saying, they only have to convince one single juror to get a hung jury. And all they have to do is raise what is called reasonable doubt in the mind of that one juror. And so they're going to try at every stage that they can through cross-examination of the state's witnesses, which they did and failed, I would say, in my humble opinion. And then through the presentation of contrary witnesses that will contradict the testimony of the plaintiff's witnesses, the prosecution witnesses. Because those witnesses were so wonderful, if Dr. Tobin had been my science teacher, I'd be a doctor instead of a lawyer. If Dr. Rich had been my doctor, or had been my teacher, I might have been a doctor. And if I ever have a heart problem, I'm calling Dr. Rich because he's here in Chicago, and so is Dr. Tobin. So congratulations, yeah. Chicago, Loyola, and Northwestern. That's fantastic. They were incredible, not just experts, but communicators. There isn't a single person in the audience sitting at home at television who didn't unbutton their collar and feel their neck for their hypothalamus and didn't feel the back of their neck. And I bet the jurors were doing the same thing. He really engaged them. And that's an important element of testifying. I don't have that sense with the current expert on defense. So, you know, it's hard to judge the defense until you see all of their witnesses and until you hear all of the cross. Because in every cross or in every redirect on the prosecution case, anything the defense accomplished has been undone. And their strategy has to be to attack the cause of death and blaming either his heart condition or his drug condition. That's their primary diversion. Their other one is the crowd was threatening and scary. And I found very interesting today watching the video of Officer Chang, who was testifying from his body cam. He was not holding physically, but was guarding the two passengers that had been in Mr. Floyd's car before the arrest. And there was not a single evidence from his body cam of a unruly crowd. And there was evidence that there was never a call for backup assistance because of an unruly crowd. And so at the same time, he was testifying one way, his video was showing something completely different. So, again, this is defense-sponsored video that I'm not exactly sure what the intent was to, you know, why they put Officer Chang on. But whatever it was, I think that they did themselves some harm by his behavior and by the fact that I couldn't hear or see anything threatening. Now, his video wasn't focused on where the crowd was. I admit that. But if they were that rowdy, his video cam would have, his body cam, would have picked up that sound. And So I mean, those are the two things that we can expect is medical testimony, use of force testimony, and crowd control issues. Those are the three things they're going to poke at. But I think that's been pre-budded by the prosecution case. They've put on enough evidence to say, here's what it is, and you can't believe anything else.
I'm talking to a former Watergate prosecutor, Jill Wine-Banks, author of The Watergate Girl. We are talking about the trial of Derek Chauvin. The defense has begun their presentation. We're going to take a quick break and continue with more right after this.
Since we have to social distance, we can get social on the socials instead.
Stay 6 feet apart, blah, blah, blah.
Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We don't even have to wear a mask.
WCPT 820.
You're listening to WCPT 820, because facts matter.
Now back to Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
Jill Wine-Banks is a former federal prosecutor. She's also author of The Watergate Girl, and we are talking about the Derek Chauvin trial. The defense has begun to present their case. Jill, I heard somebody make a comment. It was a lawyer. I don't know about trials and exactly the strategy behind them, but I heard one pundit say that when the prosecution was wrapping up, they had George Floyd's brother, Filonis, testify about his humanity, and then after that, they went back to a couple of expert witnesses. And the one lawyer was saying that they didn't really... They thought that was a curious strategy, that because the brother's testimony really humanized George Floyd, and they thought that would have been good testimony to end on. When it comes to wrapping up a case, what kinds of things does the prosecution think about, and why do you think they made the choice they did to close out with experts rather than his brother?
Well, it may have been a question of the availability of witnesses, and so that the timing may have been such that they couldn't choose to end on Mr. Floyd's brother, who I agree was a very emotional and good witness. They had so many great moments to stop. When they had one of the best moments was actually the failure on cross-examination of the expert you're talking about who followed Filonis Floyd. His name was Seth Stoughton, and he was talking about the reasonable officer standards for using force. And on cross-examination, Mr. Nelson said, a reasonable officer on the scene at the time, he was very confusing and awful, but he asked a question to which the answer was, absolutely not. You can't ignore. He was sort of saying, well, if there was no one there and he was alone in his apartment and had this heart condition, could his heart have caused his death kind of thing? It was one of those questions where he should have known the answer was going to be, no, I stick with what I said on my direct examination. And unless he had a follow-up question to which the answer would have been, yes, I agree with you, and then he could have rested. It was like he ended, and the jury was thinking, oh, man, you know, the prosecution was right. And so, you know, that actually wasn't a bad ending. And because of the other events in Minnesota, it was Dante Wright being killed by the police, the coverage got cut off of the rest of it. So I don't know what happened after that until basically the defense started. So that wouldn't have been a bad place to end as it turned out, but it was particularly good because the cross-examination was so terrible that it left a really strong impression of what that person, you know, had been testifying to. So I just think that when it came down to it, Floyd's brother, Mr. Floyd's brother, would have been a great stopping point. But it turned out that stopping after the use of force expert wasn't a bad place either. He made it clear what the standard was and that it had been violated, and then got into this really bad cross-examination that left a terrible impression.
When you're an attorney in a trial and an answer doesn't go the way you want it to, how do you recover from that? I mean, do you keep trying to ask questions till, you know, you can kind of bring it back around again, or do you just give up? I mean, that must be, you must really have to be nimble.
You do have to be nimble. The first thing is you shouldn't ask a question you don't know the answer to, except in extraordinary circumstances. And secondly, you should always be prepared with a final question that you do know the answer to that could be possibly interpreted as favorable to you. And, you know, cross-examination is a really tricky art. And it's not just a science. It is an art. And you're right, being nimble and knowing everything that is in the record that you could possibly use to undercut what the witness has said, or that is previewing what you're going to be putting on in your own case. But here, as I say, in this particular instance, I really felt that Mr. Nelson wasn't prepared and did not have a comeback, and he left it. He walked away at that point, which is the worst thing you can do. Even if you ask irrelevant questions, it's better than leaving it with a, no, I was right the first time and you're asking stupid questions. It was shocking. Oh, sorry. He just went back on.
That's okay.
I had my listening to the trial.
So what we can expect from the defense is they're going to say, oh, George Floyd died because of his heart condition. Oh, George Floyd died because of drugs. Oh, the restraint was necessary because he was just so crazy out of control. Oh, and frankly, the restraint was perfectly appropriate. And oh, boy, was that crowd scary. That's pretty much what they're going to throw up.
That's all they have. I mean, there's no question that we witnessed 9 minutes and 29 seconds of excessive force. And so they have to make it look like it wasn't excessive. They did recall a prosecution witness to talk about excited delirium, which is not a medically accepted diagnosis. And even she, I worry about things like when you recall a prosecution witness for your own case in defense. It's a little scary, but on cross-examination of her, this time the prosecution cross-examined because she was called as a defense witness, she basically said, the side recovery position is required under our training as soon as he is handcuffed. And we're also trained to do CPR as soon as we think there's no pulse. And she would certainly defer, she said, to a doctor regarding whether this was really excited delirium, as the defense was claiming. And so it seemed to me that whatever they got out of her about the existence of something called excited delirium, which could have given him superhuman strength, even in her direct examination, she said, you can go into cardiac arrest rapidly if you're having excited delirium, which means they should have put him in a recovery position as soon as he was handcuffed, she said, indirect. And they should have called the EMS right away. So, so far I'm thinking, and I have been a defense lawyer as well as a prosecutor, so I don't want people thinking that I am biased in favor of prosecution. I am biased in favor of the truth and a reasonable analysis of the evidence. And based on so far what I've seen in terms of the prosecution case and cross-examination of their witnesses and the presentation of a few defense witnesses. And I hold my opinion until I see all of the defense witnesses. But I know what the burden on a prosecutor is, and the burden of convincing 12 people of guilt is a very heavy burden, especially when you have a defendant who is a policeman that people are more, well, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. You know, it's the same thing we would have had in Watergate. If without the tapes, it had been John Dean and Jeb Magruder testifying against the president and his top aides. The benefit of the doubt would have gone to the president's men, not to the witnesses against them. And that's what happens in a police case. But I think the prosecution here has met that burden.
How long is it, you know, I've always heard, well, if the jury's only out for a short period of time, that means that they're going to convict. Or if it's out for a long period of time, maybe they're going to acquit. Is there any real truth to that? Like, if the jury comes back, like, say, the very next day, do we think that it's going one way or the others?
Well, in Watergate, they were out less than 24 hours and they convicted. Yes, I mean, there is that general belief that if it's quick, it's a conviction. But it's not always the case. And, you know, it could be one holdout. It could be six holdouts. Mm-hmm. And it's a question of arguing back and forth among the jury, trying to convince each other of their own, you know, whatever that particular juror believes. They will fight and say, well, but what about this evidence? What about that evidence? And so you can never tell. There are only, you know, three charges and there's only one defendant and the evidence is pretty clear. So I would say I would hope for a quick verdict, but it's so impossible. And one of the other reasons it's harder to predict is in this case, we don't see the jury.
Yeah.
And in fact, even the prosecutor and defense lawyer don't see the jury because they're wearing masks. So they're not seeing
what's hitting and what's not. Yeah,
exactly. It's very hard. It's like talking on a webinar where you're not seeing the audience. If I'm speaking to a live audience or to a jury, I can adjust my tone of voice, my speed, or my content based on if I see them yawning or if I see them sitting forward in their seats. And in this case, we're deprived of that clue. So it's very hard to predict how the jury is taking all of this. We are hearing some pool reporting from the reporter who's allowed in the courtroom will, you know, tell other reporters what they observe in terms of the jury reaction. And it's pretty predictable. It seems to be pretty much like I, as a viewer, am reacting to what I'm seeing. But,
well, Jill, we need to wrap this up. I got to get to news at the top of the hour. I thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. And I hope we can do this again as this trial wraps up.
Me too. It's fascinating to watch. It's worth watching.
Thank you, Jill. Jill Wine-Banks, former Watergate prosecutor, author of The Watergate Girl. We're going to take a break and be back with more right after this.
Podcasts of Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive, are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud. Just search WCPT 820. Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive.
Quite frankly, I get most of my news from you.
Joan Esposito.
Y'all ready for this?
On WCPT 820.
There is a segment that we do on a regular basis here on WCPT. It is Union Strong. It is sponsored by various unions, and we get to find out what is going on with unions, both here in the area and nationwide, what they're doing on the ground and what they're doing politically. I am joined now by Clark Johnson, who you've heard before. He's the director of marketing with FinishingChicago.com. And Dennis Roach is here. He's Chicago Painters District Council number 14's political director. Welcome to the program, Dennis. There's a lot of things I want to ask you in just a second. But first, I have a question for Clark. Clark, in the last week and a half, I've lost John Spiros to retirement. I've lost Jim Allen to retirement. I want your word of honor that you are not going to retire anytime soon, okay?
Well, actually, this is my last week, so no. I'll be here a long time, but I think we got I think both those gentlemen did a great job of handing off the leaders that are in place now. I know Joe Reinhart is, he's ready to go. He's been working with John over the last couple of years in that role. So it's a nice smooth handoff, and John's not going away. He'll he's still around to answer questions and doing some work on the collective bargaining agreement and a couple other things. So he's not going anywhere.
Well, I don't know.
He's not getting paid for it.
he told me that he had a farm that he was going to retire to. And that he was going to be a farmer. So I don't know. You know, maybe he's going to take those questions via Zoom. You never know. But I'm glad to know, Clark, that you are not going anywhere, because, frankly, that would just be too big a blow to lose all three of you at once. Dennis, welcome to the program. You are the political director, which really fits into the mission of this show. So I want to talk to you about all different kinds of things that you do as the political director. Talk about what you're doing, first of all, on the local level.
We normally, I just got my shot today, Joan, so take it easy on me a little bit.
Your first or your second?
My second, yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll be gentle then.
So if he falls asleep, he said to slap him, so that's okay.
Well, you know, I don't think you have to worry about this, Dennis. After I got my second shot, I started having hot flashes. So just in case, Clark, he starts to sweat like a maniac, you know, just know that it's just part of the experience. So I know that Painter's District Council Local 14 has supported, what, some school board candidates, some municipality trustees. Tell me about those efforts.
What I really want to express that the Painters, they might be a smaller one of the unions out there, but they're probably one of the most progressive with their feet on the street. We put the most hours in out of, and I'm hands down, the most hours in with canvassing, phone banking. I mean, it was continuous. We're relentless. We, you know, we're out there continuously, and I really want to put a special thanks out to, we got our guys on the south side. We did a lot of campaigning on the south side. But Hugo Monzo and Mike Ulacki did, they were awesome this year due to the fact that the candidates that we were campaigning for were generally on the south side. But first, before I get to that, I would like to congratulate our own guys that were running for Joliet Township Trustee Carl Farrell. He's been a union member, Painters Union member, for 7 years. He went through the apprenticeship program, former president of the Young Lions. He was successful. Matt Shepard, he was our instructor. He's been a member out of the Painters Union for 20 years, actually apprentice of the year. He's our instructor at the JATC. He was running for Manuka Cooney Community High School Board. He was a top vote getter out of that. Richard Legia, he's a 37-year-old District Council 14 member, retiree. He won. He was successful at the 3rd Ward Alderman of Berwyn. And re-election, Ron Alvarico. He's a District Council 14 member for 34 years, 8-year lifetime member. He's Lockport Township, the supervisor, for 10 years now.
Well, that's great. But, that's a lot of victories.
Yeah, we did very well this year. Out of 20 candidates we were campaigning for, we were successful in 16.
Wow, that's so amazing. That's good work.
Yeah, that's great, because we put a lot of, you know, it gives us a lot of voice on the school boards and the trustees, and Dennis will get into some of the township elections that campaign for, and it really helps to know that we have people out there who are giving voice to not only our membership, but just workers in general. That's huge for us. And in union or non-union, it's workers' rights, I think, is a key negotiating end for what we're working for whenever we're interviewing candidates. So, Dennis, you want to get into what we do with he'll get into how we pick candidates, because it's not just cut and dry. It's something that they go through a pretty extensive process.
When a candidate wants to either be endorsed or they're there for a contribution, we got an evaluation. Mm-hmm. And we put this evaluation out, and if the evaluation will say, would you cross picket lines? Would you speak at a rally? Do you believe in project labor agreements? All the questions that labor would really ask. Mm-hmm. And they fill out this questionnaire, and we go through it. They actually sign it at the end. And not that what we really do with that is when a candidate says down the road after he gets elected, we pull this out of the cabinet and we go over to him and say, hey, you said you believe in project labor agreements, and you actually signed it at the end. It's mm-hmm. something that legally we could use, but it's something that we really could use to beat them over the head with.
Well, hold their feet to the fire. You know, there's nothing exactly wrong with making somebody fulfill the promises that they made on the campaign trail. I mean, I have no problem with that kind of thing. Clark, you said something a minute ago about, you know, unions and working conditions. Before we go to break, I want to take a call from somebody who has a question that I think is really appropriate at this time. Jim is calling in from Chicago. Hey, Jim, you got a question for our union guys? Hi.
Yeah, I was going to ask the gentleman, what do they think this debacle in Alabama happened when Jeff Bezos didn't get unionized down there? Do they have any idea if they could shed some light out? I heard some labor leaders talk about it, but nobody can really get to the nub of it. What do you think happened down there? Was it just Alabama, or would that happen across the country? Thanks a million, guys. We just answered that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is he talking about what they were going
the Bessemer
after,
plant? Yeah, the Amazon warehouse that recently had a union vote, and apparently the union did not get voted in.
Yeah. From what I heard, they promised the employees a lot of things that the union would provide. So I think it was almost a delayed vote for 3 years. And to see if Amazon actually comes through with their promises. So I don't know if that battle is over with yet.
Well, that's what I figured. I was talking about it with my partner, Ray, and we were like, well, you know, they must have said, oh, you know, we'll give you better wages, we'll give you better working conditions. And, you know, if they do, all the better. But, you know, again, talk is cheap.
Yeah, absolutely. And this has happened before, and it's caved in, and then they start to organize. So, mm-hmm. And that's when you get into, you know, is it a right to work state? Is it, you know, are the laws with us or against us? And, you know, I think a lot of things that we're getting into with, you know, Dennis was talking about the PRO Act and how that would combat a lot of the right to work.
I want to take a deep dive into the PRO Act. So let's get this commercial under our belt. I'm talking to Dennis Roach, who's Chicago Painters District Council number 14, political director, and our regular friend Clark Johnson, director of marketing for Finishing Chicago. This is our Union Strong segment. We'll be back with more after this.
Podcasts of Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive, are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud. Just search WCPT 820.
Chicago's Progressive Talk, WCPT 820, where facts matter.
Don't turn that dial. Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive, returns right now.
That's all you had to say.
On WCPT 820.
It is our regular segment that we do once a month. We call it Union Strong. It is sponsored by the unions. Clark Johnson is here. He is the director of marketing for Finishing Chicago. Dennis Roach is with the Chicago Painters District Council 14. He's the political director. And right before we went to break, Clark had mentioned something called the PRO Act. And I know Dennis knows all about that. And Dennis, take it away. I want you to explain to our listeners exactly what the PRO Act is and what's in it.
The PRO Act, it ends all right to work. It all ends all right to work legislation. There's 27 states that have right to work laws. They weaken the unions and lower all the wages. Takes away all your collective bargaining agreements. The main quote what we use is, the right to work, it does sound good, but what it actually means is right to work for less.
Well, you know, that's something conservatives are famous for. They have these they have these really restrictive laws, and they give these amazing names like Let's All Be American Act, you know, and you think, well, like, that sounds good. I'll vote for that. But then when you do a deep dive into it, you find out that it's really not what it's cracked up to be. So I get you when you talk about, you know, some of the things that they've labeled, for instance, right to work, which is exactly, you know, counterintuitive.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
The PRO Act is the most wide-ranging rewrite of labor law in over 80 years. Anti-union meetings no longer are required. Normally when the new, I'm not going to use any names of any stores, but I know that when a company is hiring, they give the employees anti-union legislation to. Unions aren't good for you. You're going to have to pay union dues. With the PRO Act, those are illegal under the PRO Act. It creates a mediation process. Half of all unions fail when they vote in because the employers just refuse to negotiate and they drag it out. The PRO Act streamlines it. It makes the first contract reachable within mm-hmm. reason. They were saying 30 days, you'll have your vote. 60 days, you'll have your contract. Like I said, it ends all your right to work laws. It gives more protection to labor rights. You know, 54% of workers are threatened when organizing. One out of five people that are organizing get fired. And if you remember, with the Amazon, they were trying to organize. People, there were charges filed with the NLRB for people getting fired.
Mm-hmm.
It gives workers more power. They can't replace them. There's no ban, no lockouts.
So this is at the congressional level, right? This is federal that we're talking about,
yes.
Because that's way it would affect
exactly.
the whole country. Where does it
exactly.
stand right now? Is it in committee? Has it passed any votes yet?
It has passed through the House. It's on its way to the Senate. And I had actually talked to the International about 10 minutes after you called. And they said there is not one Republican in favor of it.
So is this one of those kind of bills that the Republicans could then decide to filibuster and kill unless we get 10
exactly.
Republicans for the 60 vote?
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's tough because, you know, again, you have these laws that are passed at the state level and, you know, that are anti-union. Again, right to work is such a cleverly named law, like you said before, but it really strips those states of any type of organizing effort. So the PRO Act would come in and streamline just a lot of things that were done in at a federal level. There is no right to work. It's actually done at the state level. So this would just eliminate all those states and solve a lot of problems for us.
Mm-hmm. This is why we need to get rid of the filibuster. I mean, there is so much that we could accomplish. And, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, traditionally a first-term president in the midterm elections, they lose a lot of seats. I don't know. This country is so politically divided, and there are still the Republican right. Party has done such a poor job of policing the nut jobs in their party that I think this could possibly be an exception. I think it is entirely possible that this round of midterm elections in 2022, that in both the Senate and the House, we could pick up some seats. However, the question is, yep. can we pick up 10 seats in the Senate? That's a big hill.
Right.
Yeah,
so what do we do?
That they can negotiate with. Yeah, right now, I mean, it's I don't know if it's getting lumped in with other legislation. It seems to be a standalone right now, so I don't know, you know, how that momentum is going to carry when it goes from, you know, from one branch to another. But it has, I mean, in a lot of states, and I don't know if they ever worked on it, you know, if they bring it down to the state level to at least lock down those states and say, hey, you know, we're for the PRO Act, we're for, mm-hmm. you know, organizing, we're for a lot of labor rights.
Well, if we can figure out how to get it in a budget bill. And then all we have to deal, you know, because when they do budget reconciliation, that's a simple majority. If we can figure out how to get it in a budget bill and slip it in that way, then we've got a shot, even with this Congress.
Right. Absolutely. But you got to bring it to the streets. It's almost like campaigning for a candidate.
Yeah,
you know, people got to understand what it means and what it's for, because I think even in some of these states, they passed the right to work and then they questioned what they did because people didn't understand it. It's just a cleverly named law.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in this case, people understand what it is. The PRO Act is there's a lot of chatter on the local levels, but you know, will it pass on the federal level? And that's a tough hill to climb.
So what we have to do is we have to reach out to these senators. We got to start educating our members and the working class about these mm-hmm. bills. Well, that's the whole key. And start banging on the phones. Start telling these senators, hey, we are for the PRO Act. We're for the working class.
Does it, do you, in your outreach, do you ever reach out to your union compatriots that are in Republican states to try to get them to lobby? I know that it's the lobbying that is most effective at the Senate level comes from inside the state, from people who they know will or won't vote for them next time around. So, you know, what are unions doing in, say, Wisconsin and Indiana and Ohio?
We do reach out. We, you know, that with the IUPAT, we have district councils that are there that are totally on board with this and reaching out to their membership, you know, and that's how it's done. You know, we mm-hmm. have to educate. That's the whole key.
And I know there's a call to action. Sometimes we do work with other states and other councils, depending on when there's a push for something like, you know, like when a state is voting on right to work. So they do campaign. Again, we campaign very well as a union. So the international union does a great job at the national level. We do a lot of campaigning even in Canada. And it really helps when you're actually can knock on doors, go to the street. It's tough in the COVID world though, Doug, because, you know, dentists actually had to change their strategy because of, you know, not knocking on the doors. I think this year actually leave pamphlets.
Yep, which is a lot of door hanging and phone banking, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. we had to resort to that.
Yeah.
Well,
we did have some candidates that actually, the dentist had a couple of mayoral candidates that they worked with that worked out really well.
We had Mary Alexander Vosca of Bolingbrook. She really wasn't sure about the unions and how they worked, and really wasn't for or against us. But once we came, and we have members that live out there, and they wanted to, hey, Dennis, what do you think about? So we give her an evaluation. She comes in and fills the evaluation. She got some questions wrong in it. We explained what they were, and then we started campaigning for her. You know, that's how
Excellent.
It's done.
That is how it's done. Guys, thank you so much. We are out of time. It is such a pleasure. And anything that we can do to help educate people and promote the PRO Act, we are right behind you here at WCPT. Clark Johnson, finishing Chicago, thank you so much for being a part of our segment today. And Dennis Roach, Chicago Painters District Local Council 14, political director. Thank you guys so very much.
Thank you.
It was fun and educational. And now
we
are going to take we're going to take a break for traffic and be back with more after this.
Do you want to get in on the conversation? You can now call or text us at 773-763-9278. WCPT's text line is sponsored by GWC Entry Lawyers. Visit them at justicestartstoday.com. Don't turn that dial.
A dangerous mistake to make.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive. Returns right now on WCPT 820.
And we are joined by David Orr. You know him as the former clerk. Now he is with Good Government Illinois, an organization that seeks increased transparency and strong ethics in all branches of government. Hello, David. How are you?
Hi, Joan. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I noticed that on your social media, you had retweeted something that kind of caught my eye. Alderman Kerry Austin was fined for taking an excessive campaign contribution, and it was a pretty sizable fine. And you retweeted this note that the Chicago Ethics Board decided to, oh, that was too big a fine. Instead of $145,000, we'll just make her pay $5,000. And then she has to, you know, pay back the $48,000 campaign contribution. Why? Why would they... Why would she get this punishment? And then the Chicago Ethics Board say, oh, you know, that was maybe that was a little too tough on you. We'll just roll that back. What was going on there?
Well, I wish I knew. Now, that just came out, I think, today. And that's why we put it out, because we want people to know. I really don't know why they did. Often, whether it's the state board or the county board, the city board, they do compromise when because most times they don't get any money back from all the fines and stuff that they give. So, you know, like they compromise with Berrios, but I don't know the real reasons. Altogether, it's more than $50,000, and I don't think there's any money left, you know, in that account. But no, I would agree. We need to be as tough as possible. Why else are you going to convince people to stop the kind of the crap that they're doing?
Well, that's one example of crap at the local level. What else is going on locally that we should be paying attention to? I know that Good Government Illinois has been pushing for legislation and ethical rules that will diminish the possibility of conflicts of interest. One of the things that you guys have been talking about a lot is whether or not it's ethical for certain legislators to have outside income, what kind of outside income would be acceptable. Is there any one particular thing going on at the local level right now that we need to know about?
Well, we have three levels that are all kind of connected and important, the city, the county, and the state. But let me, by way of introduction, you know, I mean, I'm not sure ethics is the right word. I mean, of course, we all use it. The key here is my chief concern always is how do we get fair and efficient government? You know, I mean, there's a great concern now about the inequities that the pandemic has disclosed. Now, anybody that knew anything about the injustices of race and class know it's been around kind of forever. But when you start thinking about this, and then you ask yourself, why don't we do more things when clearly most Americans want it, whether it's the working rights issues that your guest just talked about, whether it's more assistance for education, sick pay, whatever it is, a lot of this has to do with this notion of trust in government. And so my big concern always is not whether or not somebody always follows every rule. It's that the ongoing corruption and inefficiencies and cheating the system done by far too many in Illinois gives our public this notion that you can't do anything. And it leads to all these crazy things. You know, the craziness in the assessor's office and the corruption there, it led to year after year of unfair assessments hurting middle-class people the most. And I could just go on and on with those examples. So we're not talking about something that's esoteric. And the reality is, and again, I like a lot of elected officials, maybe we're too hard on them sometimes, but the bottom line is most elected officials do not want reform. They may say they do, but they don't. And right now there's a hearing going on down in Springfield. And, you know, the reformers that go in there, like the good folks from Reform Illinois testifying as we speak, you know, the legislators attack them. How can you dare say that we need to blah, blah, blah? And they're talking about things like you use that conflict of interest. They want to make it very complicated. They have a lot of clever ways to delay reforming things. But part of it is this notion that, well, it's really too hard to define. And blah, blah, blah. So, yes, one could have an outside income.
Well, they seem to know how to define it when they're running for office, David. I mean, they're usually pretty clear. These are the things I'm going to do. This is what I'm standing behind. And then they get in office and, well, you know, that's on my agenda. I haven't gotten it to it yet. And then sometimes I think they just hope people will forget what they said.
Well, exactly. I mean, again, I don't want to encourage too much cynicism because I do believe there's things that can be done.
We live in Illinois. We're born with it.
Well, born with it. But remember, we've made a lot of changes, and so let's not give up on that. But you mentioned the conflict of interest. Okay, the fundamental thing is you should not be allowed to be in elective office and not obey the fiduciary, the financial responsibility of any elected official, state legislator, city council, county commissioner. Your first fiducial responsibility is the taxpayers. So an obvious one that we could all agree with. Okay, let's pick on Ed Burke, because he's gotten away with murder for years. Okay, so if Ed Burke is an election official, and a very powerful one at that, and yet he was representing all these companies, representing Trump. In other words, his success and the money he gets as a lawyer or a lobbyist here depends on hurting the fiduciary responsibility of Chicago or the stuff that the assessor's office did or some of the games they play at the Board of Review. That is not that hard to define. Now, it does get a little tricky. You know, one should be able to do certain things for outside income. You know, most elected officials, like the county commissioners, all believe their $85,000 is that's only a part-time salary. And you can argue about that, but the bottom line is, let me just tell you what's going on right now, okay?
Yeah.
We have fairly extraordinary successes at the city level, although there's some tough issues they have to work, particularly on lobbying, okay? That's probably one of the strongest in the nation. We have some potential things in the county. We talked about before, there's some good reformers on the Board of Ethics a year and a half ago, then Preckler came in and kicked them out and basically has delayed the reforms that they'd advocated for about a year and a half. Now, Commissioner Larry Sufferton has brought those back, and those are being considered in committee as we speak. But here's the kicker. The state, okay, there's three things we should take away from this. The state could really make it good for us or really bad for us. And one of the things that it appears that the state is trying to do, even though the governor made strong promises on ethics, we're given the new speaker who took Madigan's spot, Chris Welch, an opportunity. He said he wants to see something pass. But at this moment, one of the things we've got to look out for is something called preemption. And
okay,
what that means, and preemption basically means if you pass a state law, let's say around lobbyists or other reforms, no other elected body in the state can have something stronger. When I and others passed the Tenants' Bill of Rights way back in 1986, two things the scoundrels, in my mind, opposing us did. First, they went to court, but they lost. And then they went to Springfield and tried to do something and say, Chicago now, Oak Park, and Evanston all have pretty strong tenant-landlord rights. And so they tried to preempt that. So, for example, if they could be successful in trying to preempt it, they could basically say to these significant reforms in the city, sorry, and that law and the mayor worked hard on.
So it's a way of weakening something that's already on the books. If let's say to live in the city of Chicago, you have to pay a $100 fee. They could pass preemptively a motion in Springfield that says anywhere you live in the city, you have to pay a $50 fee, and then the Chicago's $100 fee would already be knocked off. That's what you're talking about?
Yeah, and that's what we clearly don't want that. And again, like you started out by asking, bad things will happen if the public is quiet. And that's, again, there's a lot of good elected officials that frankly are being kind of quiet because it's a very unpopular thing to be an elected official and talk about ethics. The public may generally support it, but your colleagues don't. So, so one is preemption. We got to stop that, make sure it doesn't happen, okay? Because that would hurt the county, too. I mentioned Larry Sufferton, you know, he's got a fairly decent bill there. And who knows, if they had the wrong kind of preemption in Springfield, it might gut that too, which would frankly make some of the commissioners very happy. Then the other thing we got to look out for, here's the real irony. There's something called the omnibus. It's a tactic that the Springfield legislators use. And there's nothing wrong with the tactic. Could be good or bad. But the idea is we'll put it in an omnibus bill so it won't have a regular bill, it won't be a regular process. And then the caucus, in this case, the Democratic caucus, Republican caucus, if we can agree basically in secret about it, then we'll allow it to come to the floor. Now, that's a terrible way to pass ethics legislation.
Yes.
Because it means there's all this secrecy going on. All of a sudden, who knows what happens behind closed doors, because you don't know how they vote. And then all of a sudden, maybe late in May, people say, well, here it is. And then often it's, well, this is really not good, but we don't have much choice. Remember, I don't want to sound too cynical. There are definitely good elected officials. I've been pleased to know a lot of them. But the key for most elected officials is, I want to be there to wave the flag and vote for all the things that are popular, but I want to be totally oblivious when it comes to taking blame for something that's not popular. And that's why you have leaders like Madigan that were, you know, wouldn't let things come to the floor. Okay, so yeah, I'm suggesting the omnibus is the last place that this important ethics legislation, which could affect all the things we're talking about right now. Just to go back for a second. Remember, we all know about Commonwealth Edison. I just want people to really understand, when you have these scandals, okay, the Burke scandal, and the other dozens and dozens of elected officials and government officials have gone to jail, it's always around a financial thing. You know, Burke allegedly leaning on a fast food restaurant to use his law firm or else. People, you know, everybody says, for example, we all knew what that Senator Sandoval was doing. We all knew he was doing bad things, but no one would speak up. We all knew what Burke has been doing since 1975, but no one could actually kind of get him on it. Mm-hmm. That just means that they take the money, one, to discourage people from speaking up. They take money in money that therefore does not go to help a small business. The money doesn't go to help, like just the show you had on. There's so many things that we could do to make the country better and the state better. Just helping people, workers' rights, okay, helping them to make sure they get sick pay, which most Americans don't even have right now. All sorts of things if we had time to go into it. So, again, I want to just go back to that if, in fact, the money is misused in too many cases like it is, and secondly, that leads to great distrust in government, how do you do the things that Dennis Roach was just talking about? Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a good side to that, at least in my view.
Well, hold on. We want to hear the good side, but we want to take a break. David Orr with Good Government Illinois. We'll be back with the good side right after this.
Facebook.
Message us.
Instagram.
Follow us.
Twitter.
Tweet us.
They keep me connected.
Let's get social on the socials. WCPT 820.
Because facts matter. You are listening to WCPT 820.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
I am talking to David Orr. He is with Good Government Illinois, and I interrupted him as he was just about to tell us the good stuff. So please, David, tell us the good stuff.
Well, I was going to just give an example, since in my mind, both my teaching and experience in politics is we can do good things for citizens. But if you destroy that trust level, it makes it so hard for us. And that's been a constant theme, particularly in Chicago and Cook County over the years. Not always, but too often. Now, when I would say the contrast to that right now is, frankly, looking at President Biden. And what I mean by that is, all of a sudden, even though there's just 50 Democratic senators and there's some Republicans quietly trying to be helpful, the fact is, they're doing things. They're doing things the clear majority of the public likes, okay? Maybe not the majority of Republicans, but Republican voters, which is different than Republican congressmen. That's significant, because those things can't happen if the distrust in government is too high. And that's what we're fighting, and that's why some of these things are important, and people need to be talking to their legislators and saying, what are you really going to pass? I want to see specifically, what are you going to vote for in terms of conflict of interest, lobbying, and so forth? And will you promise that you will not support anything that allows elected officials to be engaged in financial activities that is in conflict with their job? Mm-hmm. And do the same thing with the county commission. I know it sounds corny, but the key to all this is whether or not there's any light shining on it. There's no light, I guarantee you. They will do some things. I mean, there's something called SEI, the Statement of Economic Interest. It's a way to deal with conflict of interest. It's a state form that lots of people have to fill out. As clerk, I had to administer that. They basically fill out the form, and it tries to get at whether or not you have major conflicts of interest. At least two of our superintendents of public schools in the last 20 years have violated that, okay, which partly helped to lead to their convictions and going to jail. But it's a very weak, poorly written, intentionally so vague, okay? So that is something they promised to reform. Now, the question is, we've talked about that for years. Shirley Simon, former lieutenant governor, had worked hard on that. Are they really going to do it? If there's not much attention on it, I guarantee you it will be melt toast. It'll be just words and nothing significant.
I probably consume more political news than the average person just based on the job I do. But I have to tell you that even though I know who my congressperson is, I know who my senators are, I have a vague idea, a reasonably good idea about who my local municipality people are. But as far as my state rep and my state senator, I know who my state representative is because I get a card from her every time she is up for reelection. But I don't even get that from my state senator. What kinds of questions should I be asking each of them? And I know that most these days, almost all political people have websites. Would you expect every political person who's in elected office to have on their website, these are the bills I'm sponsoring, these are the bills I'm co-sponsoring, this is what I voted for, this is what I voted against? Do you think that that's like a bare minimum of what I should get from my elected official?
Well, you should get it all, and you will get most of what you said except for that last thing. They're not necessarily going to tell you all the things they voted on. They'll tell you the bills that they think you like that they voted for, but they're not necessarily going to tell you on the ones that you might not like. But again, there is more information out there. Remember, there's a great amount of money. Millions have spent city, county, and state on these newsletters now because it all can be done electronically. So the point is, just like any kind of traditional lobbying, just get people to, certain things like this. I want to know where you stand on preemption. You don't always have to understand this. You're not going to get that person in those cases. You're going to talk to the staff. And you have a right to say, I want to see something in writing. I want to know, well, and again, there's people like these Reform for Illinois and other groups, maybe myself and others, that can help people if they need sometimes a little more detail. But don't worry about it. Just say, what are you really going to do? And if they say, well, it depends. You know, we don't know if we can get the votes. Well, are you going to vote for it? Will you put that on a piece of paper? Will you put that on your website that you're definitely going to vote for this or that? But again, I think I don't want to overdo the difficulty. It's one, just making noise, and two, getting the press to pay attention. You know the way the press can pounce if they really think there's a possibility here. Okay, and again, I know these are tough things. I do think we've made a difference in the county, and they're getting nervous about the delays. Okay, particularly, I think, you know, Madam President Preckwinkle, she's being hurt by this. So there may be some movement there. Springfield, like I say, those who want preemption, that's their way out. So they could all of a sudden let Chicago and Cook be freed up from some of the tougher laws they've passed. Leadership is critical. I mean, not just legislature, put pressure on the governor. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, remember, we expect things to maybe be a little bit better with Madigan gone. Okay? And the new guy, you know, he wants to show something. And I guarantee you one or two things will happen. There won't be much attention, and his colleagues will push him. I'm talking about Mr. Welch, push him to have the weakest possible reforms, what they'll call it, reforms. That's one way. Or there'll be pressure and more scandals, ideally that more people will be indicted or convicted in the next few months. That always helps to call attention to it because people get fed up with it. And if that's the case, or if the governor decides to step in, or if we get just a handful of tough-talking legislators, senators or state reps, we're going to get something better. In some ways, it's just that simple. But I guarantee you, they want a delay, and if we delay, they will win.
I want to share with you a story posted about an hour and a half ago on the Sun Times. They're saying that Rudy Acosta Sr., who was a political operative for Alderman Ed Burke and the late state senator Martin Sandoval, has pled guilty today to concealing material concealing material information from the FBI. He apparently admitted he made cash payments in order to sway Sandoval and that he, quote, facilitated bribe payments, unquote, to another unnamed official. That's
right. But there's tons more, and we all know this. We know when one of the aldermen was wearing a wire for so long. We know there's a lot of other people that are literally shaking in their boots, wondering when they're next. So the good side is that a lot of these people are in trouble. The bad side is how long it takes. You know,
yeah.
Ed Burke is still earning $120,000 a year in the city council. Everybody, like I say, the Springfield, they knew what Sandoval was doing. So I go back to that point. Sometimes there is a surprise. It's a secret, okay? But I'm trying to get at, with some of the reforms, this certain behavior. And if you're allowed to take money the way they can or use the power to try and fleece your local businesses. Now, let me just go back, and I'm simplifying intentionally because it's kind of the truth. The old politics way, the old machine way, is old man Daley, not the young Daley, he's the boss, which means you're always going to vote for who he wants. Okay, you're always going to vote for that city council. Almost no opposition, period. But in return, those aldermen were greedy. They were powerful. Okay, what did the aldermen get? Intentionally, Daley gave him something then. You're the god in your ward. And all this little stuff, parade permits, this permit, whatever, you can milk. Now, of course, I want these words, okay, because not all these aldermen are bad or whatever. But you basically can do what you want. And that really led the floodgates to so much of the corruption, the mismanagement of reforms, efficiencies, permits.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what a lot of these people are getting caught with. Or should get caught with, or why little teeny businesses, you know, tend to give thousands and thousands of dollars a year to the local alderman. You know, they barely can afford to pay their workers. So, but this indictment, people knew this was going to happen because he was just,
yeah.
They wanted to get him first. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's always the way they work, you know, get somebody at a low level and then work your way up the food chain. David, thank you. I would love to talk to you longer. We are out of time. We're going to have to schedule another visit very, very soon, my friend.
Well, next time.
And I really appreciate the work you do with Good Government Illinois.
Well, thank you. I just want to tell you, hopefully we can talk again because I believe we're going to have Senator Dick Durbin on a virtual soon, talking about the very important voting rights and what can be done and the filibuster. So
excellent. Excellent. We will definitely promote that one. Thank you so much, David. We are going to take a real quick break. We're going to have news at the top of the hour. And then when we come back, Ed Yanka is going to join us. The ACLU in Illinois has put out a legislative agenda, laws that they want to get passed, and they want you to know about. We are going to be talking about that right after this.
Want to add your two cents? You can now call or text us at 773-763-9278. WCPT's text line is sponsored by GWC Injury Lawyers. Visit them at justicestartstoday.com.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive.
Quite frankly, I get most of my news from you.
Joan Esposito.
Y'all ready for this?
On WCPT 820.
Ed Yanka is with the ACLU of Illinois, and the ACLU put out a release recently about different pieces of legislation that we as voters and people who just simply reside in the state need to know about. And I asked Ed to join us so we can talk about this. Hello, Ed. How are you today?
I'm well, Joan. How about you? It's good to hear your voice.
I'm good. I'm so jealous. You know, you talk to Dick Kay every month, and I haven't had you on this show for a very long time. I'm a little bit envious, I have to say.
I enjoy those Saturday afternoon chats. I'm not sure that Dick and I ever get to a subject so much as we just have fun. And so it's a wonderful experience.
Yeah. So are you vaccinated yet, Ed?
I'm halfway there. I have one shot of Moderna in me, and I am about a week or so out from my second one. So I'm very close.
Congratulations. I'm always so pleased to hear when people are very close to being fully vaccinated. I got my second dose a week ago of Moderna, so I am the doctors tell me I will be at peak resistance on the 20th of April, that it's going to be, well, let's just say for me, it's going to be as good as it gets.
I understand.
So I got this really interesting note from ACLU of Illinois about some bills, some of which I knew about and have talked about on this show, but some of which I did not know about. So do you want to start with the Bad Apples in Law Enforcement Accountability Act? That was one that I was interested to hear about.
Oh, absolutely. So as your listeners may know, Joan, at the beginning of the year in the sort of the lame duck session, the legislature passed and the governor signed into law the criminal justice and police reform pillar that was offered by the Black Caucus and that we at the ACLU and others were really proud to support during that time. One of these things that didn't get in the bill, and one of the things that you've seen passed recently in New Mexico and Colorado and is on the docket in a couple of other places, is the removal of something called qualified immunity for police officers. And what qualified immunity is it's really just a sort of a blanket immunity that has been created by the courts and created by the Supreme Court in particular for police officers that creates an unfair and unnecessary barrier when someone's constitutional rights are violated by a police officer, and it keeps them from being able to file a lawsuit to get damages for having their constitutional rights violated. And here's how absurd this is. A few years ago in Georgia, there was a family were playing in their front yard. When a police team swept up across the street in order to take a suspect into custody, they did it. But then the police came across the street and started questioning the family, had the family lay down on the ground face down while police had their guns drawn. The family dog started to bark. And so one of the officers fired at the dog, missed the dog, and hit the knee of one of the children.
Oh.
The mother of the child brought a lawsuit that ultimately was dismissed.
Oh my God.
Qualified immunity, because the argument was that, you know, there is in the concept here is, well, there isn't really another case that's exactly like this where an officer has been found accountable. So, you know, we can't do this. Let me say one other thing about this. We keep hearing, and it's the reason we called it the Bad Apples in Law Enforcement Accountability Act. We keep hearing that all of these people who do all of these things are just bad apples. Okay, let's find a way to hold them accountable.
Yeah.
And let's remove this hurdle so that, under Illinois law, there is a provision that says that you cannot, police cannot use excessive force on a resident of the state of Illinois. So let's ensure that people can enforce that constitutional provision. And that's what this bill does. For people who are interested, it's House Bill 1727. I will just say, if any of you are interested in this, you should go to our website at aclu-il.org. There's you'll find a thing on our 2021 legislative agenda. It's the Bad Apples Act is right at the top. And I would encourage you to call your state representative today and urge them to support this bill, because, you know, Joan, you will not be surprised that a lot of police groups police unions and others are attacking this bill because, you know, because they don't like to see this change towards accountability.
Well, and toward that end, they were effective because a modification of qualified immunity was in the police reform bill that was one of the first legislative pieces that the Black Caucus put forth after Chris Welch took over as speaker. And from what I understand, though a lot of times legislators don't really want to share with me the nitty-gritty of these negotiations, but as I understand, the provision on qualified immunity was a real stumbling block for some of the legislators, and they ended up, instead of actually changing it or altering it, they put in the bill that they would have a commission. They would form a commission, a task force to study it. And so there was opposition to this in Springfield. I'm not quite sure where it came from. Like I said, they don't really want to share their dirty laundry with me.
Let me share with you a little bit about that. So one of the complaints that the Black Caucus got for what became House Bill 3653, the Safety Act, one of the complaints they got was that this was all kind of done at the old complaint about this was the last minute. We're doing this in this truncated lame duck session. And, you know, we haven't really gotten a chance to look at this language yet. And so, you know, even though, you know, frankly, there were hearings that stretched back to the summer, just after the time of George Floyd's murder, where this topic had been discussed at great length. And quite candidly, this has been a topic that people have been discussing for years and years in terms of really trying to reverse and do something about. And you know, as I said, Colorado did it almost instantly after the George Floyd murder. You know, there was this sense of, oh, this is too much. And so they agreed to this, you know, they agreed to this commission or this study group for this session. Look, we didn't want to wait. We put this bill, you know, together. We had the language together from that time, introduced it. Representative Tarver is the sponsor of the measure. And, you know, he's moving forward. The bill is on the floor in the House. And you know, we're hopeful it will pass.
We need to take a break, Ed, but I want to continue to talk about this particular bill because it has been very controversial. And I've heard from a lot of my listeners over the course of many weeks, you know, some have real fears about it. Some are for it. I want to share some of those ideas that I've heard with you when we come back after this. I'm talking to Ed Yanka with the ACLU of Illinois. We're talking about a bill that's currently in Springfield. It's called the Bad Apples and Law Enforcement Accountability Act. We're going to continue more right after this.
There's no excuse to miss Joan Esposito.
It's number one on my stereo.
Live, local, and progressive. You can listen to her daily at WCPT820.com on your computer or phone.
WCPT 820, Chicago's progressive talk, where facts matter.
Now back to Joan Esposito. Live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
I'm speaking with Ed Yanka from the ACLU of Illinois. The ACLU of Illinois has put out a legislative agenda email where there are certain bills that they want people to be aware of. And one of those is the Bad Apples in Law Enforcement Accountability Act. It is an act that will take on the issue of qualified immunity. That is the legal phrase by which it is almost impossible to hold a police officer accountable, frankly, for their actions. And while it sounds on the surface of it like something that we definitely need to get rid of, Ed, I've heard from a lot of listeners who say, well, if the police, you know, it's a dangerous job, they have to make split-second decisions. If they're constantly rethinking themselves, they're going to end up getting killed. And nobody's going to want to be a police officer if they don't feel they have protection. People will use these kinds of laws to file all kinds of lawsuits, and police officers will be harassed. It will be harassment, not any kind of effort to find justice. How do you respond, Ed?
Well, there's a lot there. So let me sort of take this one at a time. I think that, and by the way, you know, these are all complaints that we hear. So in terms of the idea that, you know, in terms of the idea that this will be used where the most minor thing or a mistake will somehow be penalized, or, you know, a police officer will be sued for anything, it's important to remember that the bill that we're proposing actually authorizes lawsuits only in very narrow circumstances when a police officer violates someone's constitutional rights. In other words, it's not for anything. It has to raise to the point of violating their constitutional rights in terms of the officer actually being held accountable. Just taking this a little bit out of order, the idea that you know, an officer would be exposed in some ways to like a personal liability, you know, usually both by state law and contracts, based on their jobs, police are indemnified from personal liability. And so therefore, you know, this would not be personally reflected on them or their, you know, their home or something like that. But they, you know, this would simply allow someone to have the merits of their lawsuit heard, and again, the municipality or the employer would be on the hook for whatever the damages are. You know, I think on the last one about the fact that this is somehow going to affect recruitment or retention of police, this is something that, you know, number one, I'm going to say a couple of things. You know, number one, this is something that we heard after, you know, after House Bill 3653 was passed. Oh, this is changing policing and no one's going to want to be a police officer. I just don't see the evidence of that. What we do know is that every year people enter professions all over the state that provide vital services, and none of them get this blanket promise of immunity. And so it's hard to believe that somehow that police officers will only be drawn to the idea of serving in as a police officer if, in fact, they're somehow allowed to act without any kind of accountability. I just don't see any evidence of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always thought that argument was a little bit far-fetched, but I do know that police officers are worried, you know, if they're sued, you know, are they going to, as you know, who's going to help them pay for those legal costs? Is it going to be their union? Is it going to be the municipality they work for? Is this going to come out of their own pocket? Not that that's necessarily sort of the larger community's problem to figure out. I mean, the argument could be made, well, don't do anything to get sued and you won't have to worry about it. And yet we all know that there are some people who just tend to litigate everything. And, you know, what does this law, H. Bill 1727, specifically, does it specifically address any of those issues?
You know, because, Joan, it requires the injury, the violation that has to happen is to somebody's constitutional rights, and specifically to their constitutional rights under the Illinois Constitution that prohibits police from using excessive force. So this isn't just for someone who insults someone or someone who, you know, engages in a practice which is engages in something where there's a, you know, just a minor issue or a minor problem. This is about something really significant in terms of a violation of constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, by way of example, if your surgeon makes a mistake, oh, I accidentally left a pair of scissors inside your body, I'm really sorry, it was an accident, they're still responsible for that. And a lot of people are wondering what, if anything, Kim Potter, what any consequences Kim Potter is going to face. She's the Brooklyn Center police officer who apparently thought she was reaching for her taser. Apparently she drew her gun, and now a young man is dead. It's, by all accounts, she didn't mean to do it, and it was an accident, but there's still, for some accidents, there needs to be consequences. Don't you agree?
I do, and think about this. You know, I think we're all, or many of us are, you know, sort of consumed by either watching, listening, or reading daily, you know, the reports from the Derek Chauvin trial. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that what we're seeing there, where someone is actually being charged criminally for their actions as a police officer, that is a really highly unusual thing. That is not something that one, you know, usually sees. So the way to, you know, redress this, the way to get some accountability for it is through the civil courts. And what happens often is that people can't even get that day in court because this qualified immunity comes into play. If you think about it in that way, you know, I think all of us recognize that we want police officers to do their role. But frankly, we also want them, just like all of those other professions, just like you and I, you know, we want them to be accountable when they do something that is in violation of the law. That's really all this bill. It's a very simple ask in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's three other measures that are on the legislative agenda email that I want to get to. We are coming up on a break, Ed. But when we come back, a couple that I want to particularly go over are, again, ones that I wasn't very familiar with before I started reading this. Protecting Household Privacy Act is House Bill 2553. That's one I want to talk to you about, and especially the one House Bill 3701, the Illinois Healthy Youth Act. These are bills, you know, some bills like, you know, repealing the Parental Notification Act have gotten a lot of publicity. Repealing the PNA is something that I talk about on a regular basis. But some of these other acts,
continue to do so.
Yes, and believe me, I will. But some of these other things are things that I haven't heard that much about. So I'd like to focus on those when we come back. I'm talking to Ed Yankov with the ACLU of Illinois. There's some legislation in Springfield that we as responsible citizens need to know about and we need to weigh in on. And if you want to find out who your legislators are, there's a website, myreps.datamade.us. You can find out who your local, state, and federal representatives are and how to contact them. We'll be back with more after this.
Facebook.
Message us.
Instagram.
Follow us.
Twitter.
Tweet us.
They keep me connected.
Let's get social on the socials. WCPT 820. Joan Esposito. Live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
I am joined by Ed Yanka of the ACLU of Illinois. We've been talking about some pieces of legislation that are working their way through Springfield. Ed, before we get back to those other two pieces of legislation, we've got a couple of callers that want to who want to join our conversation. Let's go to Steve, who's calling in from the Gold Coast. Hey, Steve, how are you? You're on with me and Ed Yanka.
Fine. Thank you for taking my call. I was having this discussion with someone from UIC, a professor of criminology, and I still agree. I don't think you're going to have any sort of shortage of individuals wanting to be police officers. That's not where the concern lies. The concern lies in the kind of policing that you will get if police officers have second thoughts with regard to whether or not they want to be hard-charging police officers. Hey, officer, there he goes, the guy right there. He just stole my wallet. Oh, I'll take the report, but I'm not chasing anybody because I'm not going to get through. You know, so that's the kind of logic we're asking, be employed when we discuss this issue. And I agree, we do need to hold police accountable, but at the same time, that needs to be balanced with a reasonable amount of protection that we afford to police officers because of the nature of the job they do. So, for instance, I think with regard to Officer Chauvin, I certainly think that that should be that's an argument to be made with regard to someone whose personal assets should be up for grabs with regard to any sort of civil action that should be taken because of the nature of the crime that he may be convicted of. But in terms of good faith effort on the part of police officers to go out there and deal with the bad guys, should they be worried about losing their child's college fund, their home, their car, and everything else in order to protect us? No, I don't want to put them in that position. I do want to indemnify them in a way that protects them. So I think that there's a balancing act here that can't exist. There's a compromise. It's not an either-or, and that's unfortunate the way that it's been sold to too many people, that it's either protect the police or protect citizens in terms of our civil rights and in terms of our capacity to hold police accountable. And no, I think that you can have both.
Well, let's thank you, Steve. Let's let Ed Yanko weigh in on that argument. Ed?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First of all, Steve, that the indemnification already happens. So that's the piece that that police already have that protection and will continue to have that protection even after this bill becomes law. There's one other thing I think that's really interesting, though, about the point Steve makes, which is when he says there ought to be a balance. And I frankly would argue there already is, because there is literally no one else in our society that we hand a weapon and a right to take away someone's liberty and someone's life. And the balance is that they ought to be accountable for their actions because they have that much power. And so one of the things that we've tried to do here is to create, a sense of accountability because we know that in many ways what you don't want is officers just to be able to go out on the street and be able to act with impunity and not feel a sense of accountability. And I'm not saying that every officer does that. I don't think that's true. But we really don't have good mechanisms for holding those accountable when they do cross that line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we just got a text on this subject. And this is this text reflects something that I've said on this program before. Somebody texted in, if you have 1,000 good cops and 5 bad cops, if none of the good cops report the 5 bad cops, you've now got 1,005 bad cops. And I believe in Minneapolis, correct me if I'm wrong, Ed, that they've actually, whether it's in the city or the state as a whole, they adopted a policy that requires officers, if they see another officer breaking the law or doing something that they shouldn't do, they are required to intervene. They cannot just stand by silent. They are required to get involved. And maybe
that's
go ahead.
Oh, that's actually in the Safety Act that was just signed into law here in Illinois as well.
Excellent.
Because you're absolutely right, Joan. The only way that you can assure that officers aren't, going to be in a situation where they can, where they're able, to act in a way that's not accountable, because, again, all of the training in the world doesn't mean anything if officers aren't held accountable, including by one another.
Mm-hmm. We'll take one more call, and then I want to move on to some of these other bills. Tim is calling in from Chatham. Hey, Tim, how are you?
Hey, Joan, how are you today? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to say this. They put mechanisms like this in place to ensure this didn't happen. They put the weapon on your right side. They put the taser on the other side. They changed the color of the taser to yellow, and the color of your weapon is silver, black, or whatever. The weight is very different. We're looking at a weapon on the body cam. We're looking at a weapon. She's saying, tase. She's playing that up for the court and the jury. The cops have figured out how to kill you with that camera. You knew you didn't have a taser. The weight is different. How you can Google right now, John, and find out what is the difference between the weight of a taser? What is it, a few ounces?
Well, one of the people I follow on social media, is somebody who's former Air Force, And they said, well, obviously there are different models available, but on average, the average taser weighs about a quarter what the average service weapon weighs. But
exactly.
You know,
so now you see why when you look at the School of Hard Knocks, they're looking at people in society now with the degrees and all this, because they're looking at them buying this baloney about it was an accident. Since when does the chief of police come out and scream anything like an accident without saying, well, it's under investigation? Why would he immediately come out and say that? You know, they weren't this right from the jump. And everybody said, poor thing, she'll be scarred for life. But she didn't know.
She'll have a life.
She's training with her weapon. She's training with her weapon. How often, Joan, at the range? She doesn't know that she has her weapon by weight in her hand, Joan. I'm sorry. I just can't buy that.
I understand. Thank you,
Tim. And if it's a mistake, Joan, if it's an accident, just because it's an accident, she has to go. Because this could happen again.
Well, she is gone.
She doesn't know
she
the
is
weight.
Gone off the force.
She should be. She doesn't know the weight between her weapon and her taser. So if it is an accident, Joan, she still has to go because she can't tell the difference between a taser and a weapon.
Yeah, I know. Believe me, I hear you. Thank you for calling, Tim. And that Kim Potter, the officer who shot Dwayne Wright, has left the police force. She and the police chief, Tim Gannon, have both resigned. But I've been seeing a lot of that on social media. I mean, they both professional tasers for cops often have the same kind of grip that a pistol has. It's that same, you know, it's not like the tasers you see in the movie where it's like a rectangle. They make them with a pistol grip. But they are different colors. The police chief said the first day, you know, the gun is supposed to be worn on your dominant side. The taser is worn on your non-dominant side. They are different colors. And yet, Ed, when you hear that, that tape, when you hear the recording of her, that doesn't sound like a woman who was trying to execute somebody. That sounds like a woman who is horrified at what she has just done. It's just a horrible situation all around.
And again, I think to go back to the point we made just before the call, it's a horrible situation, but again, it's that thing of, we give our police officers these weapons to defend themselves and defend the public. And this, you know, there's got to be, you know, a high degree and high level of accountability that comes with that in order for us to be competent in the way that our streets are being policed.
Yes, absolutely. Let's start with one of these bills, the Protecting Household Privacy Act. And this would do what, Ed?
So, Joan, we all have, we all have household items these days that have really sophisticated kinds of sensors and microphones and the capacity to capture all kinds of really critical private information. Think about, you know, your Alexa or a Ring doorbell. I'm given to understand that this is, life is an education process. I'm given to understand that some people even have a refrigerator that talk to them. I don't need a refrigerator that talks to me personally, but you know, that's just me. And so, you know, what ends up happening in these instances is that these devices, of course, in order to serve us, in order to you know, provide the kind of thing that we're looking for, we, you know, they have to be on 24 hours a day, which means they gather all kinds of information. There are circumstances, or there may be circumstances, in which law enforcement would like to access that information. And there may be times when that is completely appropriate. But in order for law enforcement to get that information, what we think is that there simply ought to be some rules of the road. And those rules ought to include, that the law enforcement agency ought to get a warrant in order to get that information, unless there's some really extraordinary set of circumstances, you know, like a kidnapping, some kind of, you know, real threat to life, you know, that could be identified where you may, you know, need to do it sooner. But that other than that, what we really ought to do is have, you know, is have some kind of protocol in place that in Illinois, if you're going to access this information, that you simply need a warrant. It's just a reality that mm-hmm. we are living in this technological age where we have access to all this kind of equipment, but having access to that equipment shouldn't come at the price of really swapping out or trading off our personal privacy.
It seems very reasonable to me. Ed, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about the other bill, the Illinois Healthy Youth Act. I'm talking to Ed Yonko of the ACLU of Illinois and some of the bills that the ACLU wants us to know are currently moving around in Springfield. We'll be right back after this.
Surely you can't be serious.
Live, local, and progressive in your car today.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Don't fret. You can still listen to her on the TuneIn app on both your phone and computer.
Whoa! You feel that right away. It's just refreshing.
This is WCPT 820, where facts matter.
Now back to Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
I'm joined by Ed Yonka of the ACLU of Illinois. The ACLU has put out a legislative agenda so that we know about important bills in Springfield that we need to urge our state senators and state reps to pass. And one of those is something called the Illinois Healthy Youth Act. It's House Bill 3701. So, Ed, tell us about this one.
So this is a really interesting bill, and I think it's been interesting to learn about in many ways, because what this bill really does is to update and kind of modernize in a number of different ways our comprehensive sexual health education standards in the state of Illinois. And I want to say, and it's important to note that, you know, probably none of us, when we think back, really recognize that learning about sexual health education as young people, really was something that was not about just what we needed as teenagers. It was not just about learning about some sort of learning about sex or sexual health activity then. That really it's about creating kind of a toolkit of knowledge that we can use throughout the rest of our lives. And so one of the things is that Illinois's current sexual health standards could use an update here. We did this a few years ago in which we managed to make some changes. We moved away from a model that was just abstinence until marriage only. But there are new standards and new ideas and new things that need to be integrated into that for the state of Illinois. So part of what this act would do is to create a set of new standards for schools that are teaching sexual health education to ensure that the instruction is medically accurate, developmentally and age appropriate. And it also says that, you know, it has to be adapted for students either with disabilities or students who are non-English speaking students. And then there's another element of it, which I think is something that, you know, even 5 years ago or 10 years ago, we likely couldn't have gotten into this bill, but I think is really critically important, is that the bill ensures that, when sexual health education is taught in Illinois, that it has to be inclusive and affirming of people who have historically been stigmatized or excluded mm-hmm. from this, including LGBTQIA folks,
And one of the things that we found in research over the last several years, and this was a little bit of a surprise to me initially, is that youth who are pregnant or parenting are often sort of excluded or made to feel like there's nothing for them to learn in these. And I think just recognizing that range of needs, of interests, of students, of their identities, and making them feel like they belong mm-hmm. in class is really important. And the last thing let me just say two more things. I'm sorry, and I'll stop here.
That's
on
okay.
This one.
That's okay.
This one of the things that this bill does for the first time in the state of Illinois, it actually collects data on who is teaching comprehensive sexual health education in Illinois, what school districts are, and what they're teaching. So that you actually have like a catalog and a collation where you know you can get sort of a best practices or an idea, a notion of what's actually being taught and what is working. And then the other piece is that, of course, this is only for those schools who are teaching this education, so it doesn't require any school to teach it. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is quite candidly, you know, it still provides, I think, as parents sometimes want, an opt out, so that if they believe for whatever reason that their child should not or isn't prepared for this kind of education, it's the parent's decision as to whether or not, you know, the information will be shared. But to be sure, you know, other students will still have access to it and the advantage of having learned it.
Ed, as people hear about these bills, when they reach out to their state rep or their state senator, what should people say? I mean, is it just as brief as talking to a staffer and saying, well, you know, there's some things, there's some House bills that I really hope my representative supports, and they are this? Or do you have a sort of a template for people? People are sometimes more comfortable calling if they kind of know what they're supposed to say.
I agree 100%. So let me say, let me sort of take this. There's a number of different things. So when you go to the section on our legislative agenda on our website at aclu-il.org, under each bill, we provide a number of different things. We provide additional information on the bill. If you're hearing me, but you're not quite sure if you would support it or you had a question that you didn't get a chance to ask, this is the way that people can get that information or get to us and ask the information as well. Then we provide two ways of people contacting their legislators. Number one, you can send a message by just clicking on a link, and you can, you know, send an email that's pre-populated with information and with a position that you can fill out and send that into your rep based on, you know, if that's something you're more comfortable with. Or we provide a number, and even, by the way, if you aren't quite sure who your state representative is or you think you know, you can call the number. It'll ask you to put in your zip code, and then it will connect you to your representative's office. There's a couple different things you can do once you get there. You can simply just say, you know, we were talking about the Bad Apples Act, which is House Bill 1727. You know, you can simply say, listen, I'm calling today because I'd like my state representative to support House Bill 1727. I support it. I'd like for him or her to support it as well. And that's all you have to do. You know, if you're someone who feels like, again, there you want more information, you want to be able, in case, you know, you want to ask the rep to call you back and talk to you about a particular issue. And every one of these bills, when you go to, you know, when you click on the bill name, you're going to get more information, including a fact sheet that will give you a kind of a you know, pre-programmed set of, you know, data and facts that you could say to your rep, I want you to support it because of this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if that's the kind of thing people feel comfortable with. And I will just say that the other part is if there's even more you want to do, if you want to, you know, meet with a state representative about this and you aren't sure, then I would encourage you to reach out to us. You know, we can give you, you know, talking points, additional information if folks want that. Because people have a as you point out, you know, people have a different level of comfort about, you know, what it is they actually want to do and what they're most comfortable with.
And also, if you go to that site, I've tweeted out the link, by the way, if you didn't remember it and don't know it off the top of your head, you can go to my social media on Twitter at Joan Esposito, CHI. And I've tweeted out a couple of links today. But you can go to the ACLU website and you can also sign up for a virtual program. You want to find out more about that bill on police accountability? Well, there's going to be a virtual program this coming Monday, the 19th, from 7 to 8 p.m. Ed is too shy to promote it, so let me do it on his behalf. You can go to the website and you can click on the link and you can sign up, and it'll be a more in-depth look at that one bill. Ed, thank you for joining us. It is always a pleasure. Now I know why Dick has so much fun with you. I missed having you here. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ed.
Thank you, because, well, you know, Dick and I could both reminisce about being older, so that you can't do that, but Dick and I
are able to do that. Thank you, Ed Yanka. That's going to be it for me today. Remember, Santita will be here tomorrow at 6 a.m. Stay safe, my friends. Have a good evening. Good night.